everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside scoop on food, wine, and the finer things in life. We broadcast a new show every Wednesday at noon on the Heritage Radio Network, and you can always find us at restaurantguysradio.com.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm doing fine, settling into our new home here on the Heritage Radio Network.
Yeah,
very happy about that.
This seems to be going pretty well.
With a bunch of other great broadcasters. So today we're going to interview Gerald Asher. He was the food writer, the wine writer for Gourmet Magazine for 20-something years. He's a terrific writer, and we're going to talk about a new book that he's just has published. But I want to start with a rather disturbing story that we haven't talked about yet. But there is a lot of counterfeit honey on the market.
You got to start out my morning with disturbing, really?
Sorry, buddy. I know you drink a lot. You drink a lot of tea with honey in it. you know, this may sound like a trivial thing, but it's really not. Bees have been in the news a lot recently because bees are very, very important. And honey is obviously the product of bees. As well, of course, bees pollinate 60% of the foods that we eat, and without them, our food chain would collapse.
Right. I was going to say, the honey that the bees, you know, when Francis and I talk about bees most of the time, the honey is, we think of almost as a byproduct.
Secondary,
We talk about that pollinating is their primary purpose.
Well, but honey is a big business, and honey is a great and natural sweetener, and we drink a lot of honey in the United States, or eat a lot of honey in the United States. A report that came out in Food Safety News. It's by Andrew Schneider, who's a 2-time Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter.
If you get a chance to read this, it was a really great article.
Yeah, you can find it at foodsafetynews.com. Andrew Schneider came up with, here's the first paragraph, a third or more of all the honey consumed in the U.S. is likely to have been smuggled from China and may be tainted with illegal antibiotics and heavy metals. Okay.
That's a problem.
That's a problem.
I don't know if you know this, Francis, and for our listeners, you know, my wife has refused to serve the kids any food that is produced in China. She just decided that.
Really?
Too risky. If made in China, no matter what it is, and usually, you know, that's going to be a lollipop or it's going to be some kind
of
non-perishable, super sweet food that the kids really want to have. And if somebody gives them a lollipop and it says made in China on the back, they don't get it. Jennifer doesn't have very many food edicts where, you know, this is it, this is the rule, 100%. You know, most of the foods we have in our house, you know, that's really junky for you, but in small quantities, once in a while, you can have it. Her no Chinese food, and not no Chinese food, but,
I gotcha.
But no food from China is an edict in my household.
But the edict's not going to work on this because what's
exactly.
happening is this honey is being
smuggled.
Honey laundering scandal here. They're transshipping it through other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And China has had a problem with a couple of diseases, and they treated those diseases with some antibiotics that are shown to be deleterious to definitely kids and the old people.
Well, they make you more prone to cancer and can actually have, you know, affect your DNA.
And, right, DNA damage in children can happen. And who eats a lot of honey? Kids mm-hmm. and old people, you know? And you.
And realize honey's in a lot of, you know, we're not just talking about the honey that you spoon into your tea or spoon onto your bread. Honey's in a lot of foods.
65% of the honey used in the United States goes into cereals and other things that are manufactured. Now, what they're doing here is they're shipping this honey from China to places like India because we know in the United States while Chinese honey is not illegal in the United States, there are strict tariffs on Chinese honey in the United States because they're dumping honey here.
Mm-hmm.
And the other problem is that Chinese honey is illegal in Europe. Europeans will not accept Chinese honey. And there are many reasons. One is the presence of these antibiotics. And two is the presence of lead. And there's evidently a significant amount of lead in the honey that's coming from China for a couple of reasons. Poor beekeepers along the Yangtze River and other places have made sort of crude beehives, soldering with lead solder them together. They're also storing the honey in barrels, crude barrels that are soldered. And this imparts a tremendous amount of lead to the honey. And we all know that honey is it really transports a lot of things. There's a story we did about bees who had found their way into a, some sort of chemical factory, mm-hmm. into some food factory, and they mm-hmm. got to the red
maraschino
color,
cherry.
Maraschino cherry factory.
Yep.
And they found the high fructose corn syrup, red dyed maraschino cherry juice or whatever it was, and the bees turned red and the honey turned red.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing they're doing is they're you can trace honey through pollen that exists. You can see where it comes from, mm-hmm. although that's very hard to do. There aren't a lot of labs that are doing it. So what the Chinese have started doing is fudging shipping documents and ultra-refining and filtering out all traces of where the honey came from. But then they have to it's colorless and it doesn't taste like honey anymore.
So then they have to put all kinds of things into the honey.
Or they blend it with a little bit of local honey. Anyway, this is a dollars and cents issue. I mean, the honey supports American beekeepers. And there's a tariff for a reason. We have an unhealthy, unsafe product, and it looks like ICE and the FDA.
Hold on. I'm going to disagree with you there. The purpose of the tariffs is to make more money on their honey. That's the purpose of the tariffs, not because it's unsafe. If it's unsafe, we would stop
yes,
bringing it in.
The purpose of the tariffs is that their government is supporting mm-hmm. honey that our
right.
beekeepers
it's artificially inexpensive
that our beekeepers can't keep up with. And if we lose our beekeepers, we're in a hell of a lot of trouble. So this is a pretty serious thing. It's the FDA that seems to be dropping the ball on this, and it's quite obvious if you read the article that there's serious documented proof that this is happening, and it's one of those secrets that's in the open. Everybody knows this
right.
is happening.
People know which companies are bringing... I'm sorry, we don't, unfortunately. But apparently people in the industry know which companies are bringing in illegal and possibly tainted honey and which companies aren't. And I don't know. That's very disconcerting to me. Whenever something is put into the mainstream food supply that our government has said, no, this shouldn't be in the mainstream food supply, and it's just being allowed to happen. That is just so disconcerting to me. As you know, shouldn't we be doing something about that?
Well, because to get the government to say that in the first place, you've really got
right.
to prove it beyond a shadow of a
exactly.
doubt.
Exactly. I know how that organization works.
So I think that's yet another reason, though, that we should, if you have some local honey produced by a local beekeeper, and we have that in farmers markets all across America, I think that's yet another reason to buy locally and know where it comes from. You can find the guy who has the bees and go to your local farmer's market.
And I'm going to remind you guys, take a look at the back, the one that I see the most, because this is one of those things that people like to give your kids. Those big swirly lollipops, the ones that are like from the old time candy shop,
right.
that are the giant lollipops that you would eat for 2 days.
Yeah.
Almost all of those are made in China.
Really?
And you just take a look at the back, and you should it should say if it's imported from China or not. Now, there's lots of ingredients that could be imported from China that we don't see labeled as such, but when something is as a whole product imported that way, you know, listen, we've had enough experiences already with the way the Chinese manage
regulate
their food that's something that we should be paying close attention to.
And there are only 7 or 8 honey processors in the United States. And if they stop buying this honey, then we'll stop seeing this honey. But this is an open secret. It's happening in public. And look, if Europe and many other countries in the world have banned the importation of Chinese honey, what do we become if we allow it? We're the dumping ground of unsafe products.
They must sell it to us because no one else will buy it.
And, they wouldn't not buy it. There was nothing wrong with it. Anyway, so watch your honey, and for now is the time to really seek out your local producer and find locally produced honey, and that's the way that you can avoid this issue at home. But remember, it's still your problem because 65% of imported honey goes into processed foods, and it's winding up somewhere. So there's our little lesson for today. Hey, let's have some fun with Gerald Asher, formerly of Gourmet Magazine. He's wrote a great book about wine, and we're going to talk with him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on RestaurantGuysRadio.com and the Heritage Radio Network. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. It's Mark and Francis. And today our guest is Gerald Asher. He is the author of several books, The Pleasures of Wine, Vineyard Tales, The Wine Journal, and On Wine. He is a James Outstanding Wine Professional of the Year by the James Beard Foundation in 2009. And his current book is A Vineyard in My Glass by Gerald Asher.
Gerald Asher, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Now, this book that's just come out, I read it through just last night, And it was just a wonderful walk down memory lane, and it was a wonderful perspective on wine. These are your collected writings over how many years?
Well, you know, I started writing for Gourmet in 1972. I'm not saying that these go back that far, but certainly in this particular collection, I imagine they cover at least 20 years.
And in looking back at 20 years worth of writing, everything in this book really seems fresh and relevant, and I want to talk about your perspective on wine in a couple of minutes, because you offer what is, I guess today, a refreshing perspective on wine from my perspective. It's less analytical of individual wines. There's nary a score in the book. I don't know how anyone uses a book without a score, right? Is it possible to talk about wines without assigning a numerical value to each one?
Well, of course it is. In fact, you know, one mustn't confuse a wine writer, which is what I am, that is someone who writes about wine, and a wine critic, someone who picks wines apart and then says, who hands out the school prizes?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't do that. And if the writing seems fresh, and that's a great compliment, it's partly because each time I write an essay on a particular wine or region or whatever, I try to get at the verities, the basis of what that place is all about. And although in doing that, I give what at the time are contemporary examples, and I talk to people, some of whom are no longer with us, basically what I'm saying was true then and is true now. And you might have noticed that the way the University of California Press handled this collection was to ask me to leave each essay exactly as it was originally published, so that it is a kind of snapshot of what I was thinking about, whether it's Chardonnay or Brunello di Montalcino or whatever, at the date it was published. And the date it was published is shown so that everyone can see that. But I follow it up where it's necessary with the briefest of footnotes, so that any facts I give that were ephemeral, I mean, for example, if I say there are 10,000 acres of Cabernet Sauvignon planted in the Medoc, and in fact it's now 12, in the footnote I make that correction. So they're not only fresh, they do bring you up to date.
Gerald, I look back, Francis and I have been doing this radio show now for a little over 6 years, and occasionally I'll go back and listen to one of our podcasts, one of our old shows, and I find that my opinions are fairly similar today as they were 6 years ago when we first started doing this show. Now, that just may be because I'm really stubborn and closed-minded, but my opinions today, maybe they're more well-informed than they were back then, but they haven't changed all that much. As you go back and look at 30 or 40 years of writing, does the same thing happen to you, or do you feel that your opinions on some subjects have changed?
No, I think what you just said about your programs holds true for these. You know, the only thing is, writing as I was for a monthly publication, Gourmet, almost all of these first appeared in Gourmet, occasionally I would touch on something that was entirely topical. For example, I might write a piece, as in fact I did, about the 88, 89, and 90 Bordeaux wines, what made one vintage distinct from another, and how I thought they were, and giving examples and so on. That's not of much interest to people 20 years later, because we've gone on since then. And those kinds of articles, which I recognize, wouldn't really be of long-term significance. Well, I suppose it might be to those who are looking at them from a historical point of view, are not included in these collections. Because there are two collections, actually. There's one which you have in front of you, and there is another one which will be appearing in March. But they're all of them essays which really do hold up in time, which do go into the verities of a particular region or a particular grape, a particular wine. And I think that my idea and certainly the University of California's idea, was that these would provide touchstones for people.
What is the difference between the collection that's due out, that's not yet published, and the current one?
Oh, well, I tell you, it's a subtle difference. When we selected the wines for A Vineyard in My Glass, what we were really trying to do was to pick out those essays which, without getting into technicalities of terroir, although here and there it does leak in, showed simply by the way I discuss, doesn't matter what wine it is, a particular wine, whether I'm touching on the type of weather, soil, the approach towards winemaking of the people, I'm illustrating, without so much saying so, what terroir really means. When you read one of those things, you understand why Vouvray is as it is, and why Fronsac is as it is, why Saint-Estèphe is as it is. So what we're trying to do, that was the whole point of the title, A Vineyard in My Glass, was to illustrate why a wine is rooted in its origin and the people who make it. And but we haven't beaten you over the head with it. But that's really what is the theme that runs through that collection. When you read those, you're absorbed by each one. But you come away from the reading of each one of those essays or chapters, whatever you call it, with a pretty good idea of the basis of Corton, or the basis of Albarino, or the basis of any of those wines, why it is as it is. There are no points. There's no competitiveness. There's no saying Joe Blow makes better wine than Henry Smith. But you get a really thorough knowledge of why the wine is as it is.
You know, Gerald, I had a great deal of pleasure reading through this book, and I've read your articles in Gourmet, of course, over many years. Mark and I are about 46. We've owned our own restaurant now for 20 years and been in the business for about 25 or 26 years. And, you know, it was always fascinating to read your articles, but I never saw them all together in one piece. And reading through this book, it reminded me of one of my favorite books, pretty much of all time, having to do with wine, was Kermit Lynch wrote many years ago a book called Adventures on the Wine Route. And I was in the midst of reading so many books trying to solve the puzzle of wine and understand how to analyze wine and buy wine and explain, you know, what grape variety it was and how to rank one against another or how much to pay for one or where to drink with one. And then I read Kermit Lynch's Adventures on the Wine Route, and it didn't really have a lot of that information. And what I always said, because we began teaching wine classes shortly thereafter, and what we always said to people was, you know, here are all the books to learn the how of wine. And here's a book to learn, you know, why it matters and that you love it. And I think that your essays in this book are concerned more about, you know, contextualizing, you know, why one should give a damn rather than, you know, anything else.
Well, I think that's always been my feeling about wine and writing about wine. I felt I owed it to the reader, not just to go off on an ego trip and you know, just give my opinions of wines. I mean, obviously, if you're writing, to some extent, your opinion is there in what you choose to say and what you choose not to say. But they're not opinions as such. I mean, everything is based on very hard research. I was privileged. You know, Gourmet is Condé Nast, and Condé Nast has always been very... I don't want to use the word generous, but certainly has enabled its writers to do proper research. I mean, behind every one of those pieces, there was at least a week spent in that region. But because of my work in the wine trade, I was always in and out of those regions anyway, and had been for the last 50 years. So I knew people, I knew who to go and talk to, I knew the background, and then given a week just to go there and gather the specific information that I needed, given as I'm blessed with a really good library, and putting all that and yet portraying it so that people didn't feel that you were just thrusting erudition down their throats. I mean, no one wants that either. But everything is based on careful research, well presented, I think, so that it's digestible. I don't know, probably I'm talking a lot of... Not at all. And, you know, you mention Kermit's book, which I think is terrific. I think that and the Accidental Connoisseur, which is a similar book, are tremendous fun to read, and they do bring wine alive. They're terrific,
Gerald.
And both of them have that same quality of immediacy, because you know that those who wrote them were there on the spot, spoke to these people, and are quoting what they are saying. And again, I mean, opinion always comes into these things, but essentially, you're getting real information.
Yeah, as a wine merchant, I look at, having been at the place, it gives me such a broader perspective about what I'm tasting in the wine. It gives me such a better understanding about what I'm tasting in the wine. And I felt like, for years and years now, that your writing was designed to try and give people that sense of place, to try and give people that understanding of, you know, if you were here, these are the smells you would be smelling, these are the things you would be touching, these are what make this place different than the next town down the road. And that's one of those things that frankly, the best way to achieve is to be there and see it and taste it. But the next best way is to have somebody explain it to you. And so I'm constantly in the position of trying to put my customer in that place as best I can. And it seems to me that's what your writing is trying to achieve, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I feel that I went there on behalf of. And I went there on behalf of the million readers of Gourmet. And I do assume that the person I'm writing for has a certain way of looking at things, is interested in these details. I try to make it as simple as I can. I try to do it in a way that the facts come through the writing. I think I've said as much as I need about my writing.
Let's take the conversation to a slightly different perspective. You were writing about wine for Gourmet magazine, which was, you know, interestingly, not a wine-specific journal. This wasn't the Wine Spectator magazine. This was for people who were interested in all things culinary. And so I think you reached a much broader audience, and you've been doing it over a time period where, you know, the birth of the American wine consciousness, you know, in the broader society. It's been an incredible period of time. I mean, when Kevin Zarelli was the cellar master of Windows in the World, they opened it, 1976, and it immediately became the largest restaurant wine cellar in the world. The Wine Advocate didn't exist. Robert Parker didn't exist. The Wine Spectator didn't exist. But Gerald Asher was writing about wine for Gourmet magazine, and you've seen an increasingly enthusiastic, increasingly broad, and increasingly knowledgeable customer base. I mean, we see that from the restaurant end, and obviously through our consulting and the radio show. It must have been a very exciting, you know, 25-year period to be writing about wine for the American public.
Yes, it was. I enjoyed doing it. And the nice thing was that the magazine was both supportive and they left me alone. You know, the arrangement was I wrote about what I wanted to write about. And other than having the assistance of very good editors there and some research if I needed it, the magazine really gave me a free hand. Just occasionally, someone would say, listen, this article runs to 4,000 words. I mean, that's a bit much. You're going to have to cut some. But everyone else I know who writes about wine were always saying to me how lucky I was, because if they were writing for newspapers or magazines, they might be able to do 1,500 words. But I almost never wrote less than 2,500, and sometimes it was more than that. And you can't really get into a subject unless you can expand a bit.
Gerald, I've always said the definition of a great partnership is they're always there when you need them, but they're never there when you don't.
Well, I can't be too complimentary about my colleagues at Gourmet. I mean, it was Jane Monton, who was the editor-in-chief for years, who took me on to do it. And I remember when I said to her at the beginning, "Now, Jane, what do you want me to write about?" And she said, "Oh, you decide."
No, that's great.
And that was that. And that's how it went on. But you asked about the second volume, and although I hope I'll have an opportunity to talk about that after it's appeared in March, the second volume, A Carafe of Red, is more all the contexts of wine. The history, the enjoyment of it, where it leads to. I enjoy the pieces in A Carafe of Red, even more than in A Vineyard in My Glass, because there I was really able to let myself go. In a couple of the pieces, you stop about halfway through and think to yourself, I thought you were supposed to be writing about wine. But anyway, that's coming up in March.
So what we're saying is that will be Gerald Asher letting his hair down, and we can't...
or cutting it off, I don't know.
Well, now, I just want to stay on Gourmet for a moment or two. We were all shocked when Gourmet ceased publication. I mean, that was an American institution. Probably, as far as a food magazine in my lifetime, that was the rock of it all. Did it catch you by surprise as it did everyone else?
Everybody by surprise. You know, the world changed. I mean, the magazine itself had changed in those last few years. I had stopped writing articles in 2002, I think, about 3 years after Ruth Reichel came on board. I stopped writing articles, and I continued with the magazine only to select the wines for the menus and to write a few hundred words about the wines that I'd selected. So I wasn't writing articles anymore from 2002. I don't know. You know, the whole print industry has gone through so much, and who knows what contributed to that decision. But it did strike me as odd. Remember, Gourmet, even at the time it closed in November 2009, had close to 1 million subscribers, and for a luxury magazine, that's an awful lot. And they were pretty devoted subscribers too. I suspect that, in fact, don't suspect, we all know that the economics of a magazine hinge as much about the advertisers as it does about the subscribers. The subscribers are there to justify the advertisers spending what they do. So there must have been some kind of disconnect with the advertisers. I did notice that the style of advertising and the range of advertising had changed in the last few years, and that might have had something to do with it.
Gerald, do you think it'll ever return?
I'm sorry?
Do you think it'll ever return?
I really Gourmet? Don't know. I was never in touch with anyone over at Condé Nast. I always dealt directly with first with Jane and then with Gail. My connection with Ruth was, although I'd known her for years, was not as close. So I don't know. I don't know what happened, and I don't know if it would ever come back. What they did say, and I think they are doing, is doing an app or whatever that's called, so that you can access a number of things from an iPad. But I don't, and it could well be that the day of that kind of magazine, which was I think what's known as an aspirational magazine, I don't know what place there is for it, you see.
Mm, interesting. Well, you know, let's take it back to the book, because we only have a couple more minutes, and I want to ask you about your book. When looking back over the essays to include in them, I mean, obviously you had to make a choice of which were the most relevant and which are timeless. I'd like to know, of the articles that, of the essays that do appear in the book, Which of them is really your favorite? Did you say, my goodness, that was good, and this is still quite relevant today, and this disc still needs to be out there today? Is there a favorite? And then I'll give you a fair warning. My question is, did you come across anything in looking back at your former writing, say, oh, my God, that's dreadful. I'm sorry I ever published it, now, and it'll never see the light of day again?
Well, I don't think there's anyone that I thought was dreadful, because if I did, I wouldn't have included it in the book. But obviously there are some which are favorites, but it's hard to say why they're favorites. It's not necessarily because they're so brilliantly written. I suspect that the ones I like a lot are those that bring back memories that are particularly happy ones for me, but they might be meaningless for others, you see. So I don't know if I can get into that. I mean, I'm going to open up the book and just quickly run my eye down the contents if there's time.
Well, one of the articles that really spoke to me that I still am explaining to people in the dining room is when you wrote about mountain fruit and how mountain fruit can be very specific, a very specific thing to make and has a very specific rewards in the glass. And I just thought, well, you know, that's really relevant today. I explain that on the floor twice a week to people because we have a lot of mountain fruit from the New
World.
Oh,
that's definitely so. I suppose you're thinking of the piece I wrote about Mount Vida.
Yes.
But then I touch on it in other ways as well. But that is true. And you know, in the ancient world, wines were always grown on hillsides, not on the flat at all. And much of what we call mountain fruit are really steep hillsides rather than mountains. The mountain that I do write about in this piece is Courton. And that is one of my pieces that I really like for a number of reasons, and I think it's a pretty thorough examination of what Courton means and what it's all about.
And does this theme come through again when you write about Mount Vida? Because I found that fabulously interesting.
How did I come to write about Mount Vida?
Well, no, I mean the idea of mountain fruit and Mount Vida and the difficulty of it, then it was a relatively unknown or lesser known phenomenon among wine drinkers, certainly, that, you know, mountain fruit should be any different than valley floor fruit.
Well, that's why I wrote the piece, because now you know that it is. And in fact, when you think about it, mountain fruit, whether it's from the mountainside of the Saar or Ruwer in Germany, or from Mount Vida here, or from some of those very steep vineyards around Roussillon, those wines are always more distinctive. And I think there are several things that contribute to that. I mean, the first is that the steeper the slope, the more washed out the soil becomes. So that it's the vine really has to work there, really has to send out deep roots to find the nutrients it needs and to find the water too, because water runs off. So you get a very good network of roots for the amount of vine that there is above ground, feeding the very sparse yield, because they're also very sparse yielding mountain vines. So that's going to make a distinction right there. And since it's always that side of the mountain or hill or whatever that faces south, and you're going to get very good sun, you're going to get good ripe grapes. They're going to be very small grapes to protect themselves against that sun. You're going to get very special conditions. And that's not to say that all mountain wines taste the same, because of course they don't. And we just think of a Syrah grown in the northern Rhone, which grows on a steep slope, and Cabernet grown on Mount Vida. But they have certain characteristic qualities in common, and that is this kind of intensity and really sharp definition, which makes a mountain wine different from others. You could say it's like people who choose to live on a mountainside. I mean, you have to be rather special to do that, and you're going to be a bit different from the guy who sits on a deck chair down on the flat by the river.
That would be me, the guy on the deck chair down by the river. Okay. But I fully appreciate everything you said.
It wasn't the best analogy.
No, it was a perfect analogy.
It was a good analogy. I might have used, Philadelphia Flyer fans as my analogy, but, however you want to go there.
I'm definitely the guy on the deck chair, I'll be honest with you. Gerald, it was lovely talking to you. Thanks for coming to talk about your book.
Thank you.
The book is called A Vineyard in My Glass by Gerald Asher. You can find out more about it and even order it if you like. Link to it through restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment on Restaurant Guys Radio and Heritage Radio Network. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and the Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome, but it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo, for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional, and that can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. I have to point something out to you, Mark.
Yes, sir.
I got Gerald Asher to laugh.
Yes, quite a feat. He was more than laughing. He was guffawing.
It took me a half an hour, but I got Gerald Asher to laugh hysterically on the radio. I bet that's not common. I don't know. I thought I was going to get him at the Gerald Asher Lets His Hair Down article, which is what the cover of the book should be, and it would sell. But
that's true. Yeah. Gerald Asher Let His Hair Down.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I earned my pay for the rest of the show, so I'm just not going to talk anymore for the rest of the show.
Well, that'll be perfect for me.
And by the way, I just want to share something else with you on a personal note. I know that when you're talking about, a perfect partner is there when you need him and not when you don't. Okay, Gerald didn't know this. I know you were talking about me. I know that that was a masked criticism of me.
You could be there a little less sometimes, for sure.
Man, no, I'm just perfect part. You know what a perfect partner is? Not Francis. That's what a perfect partner is. Not Francis. Don't look there.
Gerald Asher, his writing, when you look at Gerald Asher's writing, one of the things that Gerald is trying to do, I believe, is put you in the place. He's trying, he's trying to put you there. He's trying to make you
feel.
Hold
on a second.
Yes, sir.
Do you think he knew who the Philadelphia Flyers were?
No, he's got no idea who the Philadelphia Flyers were.
I think he was like, it must be aviators in Philadelphia. It must be a club of aviators.
Anyway, when Gerald writes about a place. Again, he doesn't talk a lot about scores and who makes the greatest wine and who makes the least great wine. He talks about the place. And so you and I have done a fair amount of traveling into wine country, and we get to go places and taste wines and get some of that perspective. And I really do think it makes us better at our jobs and gives you a chance to really see things in a wine that you wouldn't otherwise see.
That's what we tell the IRS when we write up our travel expenses anyway, I'll tell you that much.
So I remember a trip, and you and I went to this place at different times, but kind of followed the same route on a trip.
Our own adventures
wine
on
tasting
the wine
trip.
Route.
Yes, yeah. Kind of. there when you need them, not there when you don't.
I'm more fun. Gerald Asher is a very sedate guy, by the way. I have a ton of fun all built up inside me that has to come out. I only got 4 minutes left. Go ahead.
So as we went on this trip, and I know you'll know the place that I'm talking about, Francis and I were doing some tasting in the Loire Valley and some other places throughout France. And I went to this vineyard in Chinon, to the caves in Chinon.
Yeah.
And there was a specific wine, and since I'm going to talk badly about it, I'm not going to.
The moldy vineyard.
The moldy cellar.
The moldy
right.
cellar.
There was a wine that, from Chinon, red Chinon, made from Cabernet Franc that Francis and I had tried a bunch of times.
Always something off-putting in it.
And there was always something a little funky about the wine.
Not in a good way. Funky can sometimes mean good. This ain't the groove train.
This was not my groove thing.
Yeah.
So, just we would taste the wine. You know what? Go to the vineyard, taste things, get some new perspective, had an opportunity to visit. Let's go. So I remember going to this particular vineyard, and the moment you walked into their cellar, you got that sense of place that was in that bottle. That they had their own specific black mold, and they were very, very proud of
the black mold that grew in their cellar.
It was
the terroir of the place. They felt it. You know, their wines are a signature because – and the cellar smelled – had a smell that I can only attribute to this black mold, this particular black mold. And, you know, look, cellars are moldy. Cheese is moldy. Mold isn't always a bad thing. But this was something that they thought of as very good as a signifier, and I thought of as, wow, you grew up here, right? So you don't know that that doesn't, you know.
Well, it was specific.
Amazing.
One of the things that it was, though, was specific of that place. It was specific of that vineyard. And there would be really no way to connect those dots unless you were there.
Right.
Or somebody told you.
And if only we liked that character,
correct,
we would be telling that story and selling that wine like hotcakes.
Right.
You know, it does remind me of something. You know, you talk about one of the things that restaurants need to keep from developing or can fall victim to is too much of a house palate.
Mm-hmm.
But we want a house palate at Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. You know, Alex is our sommelier and helps buy some of the wines and makes buying decisions for us and goes to tastings that we don't go to, and we trust her palate. And John Kafarski before her was the sommelier, and we trusted his palate because we have a house thing that we like, and we can talk about wines in a certain way. But in wineries, very often people will go and taste in other places to keep from getting a house palate like those folks have a palate, obviously, where they're like, oh, it's the mold, it's, you know, it tastes, you know, it's because they're so used to it that maybe they're not listening to what others might think of that. And I'll always remember visiting George Hendry, who has a great palate and makes many different kinds of wines, one of our favorite winemakers.
Out in California, in Napa.
Out in California, before he built his winery, so a long time ago. And Susan, his partner, was the first time I met them, and I'm walking the vineyards with George for 2 hours, 2.5 hours in the hot sun. And I'm dying of thirst, and he says, oh, can I get you some water? I'm like, yeah, sure, George, that'd be great. And he hands me a glass of water. And, see, George grew up on the Hendry Ranch. And the sulfur that they have on the Hendry Ranch.
Off. By the way, if George ever offers you a glass of water.
Well, they filter it now.
Ask him if he's got a bottle.
Yeah. Well, so he hands me the water. I'm dying of thirst in a field, and the water smells to me and tastes to me like rotten eggs. And I am really in a quandary. I'm like, oh, I'm thirsty. Oh, I hate that water. Oh, I'm thirsty. I hate that water. And when I went back, Susan, who's his neighbor, who does not get water from the same well, said, oh, I didn't send you out with water. You had Georgia sulfur water. And, you know, if you grew up with it, you don't think anything unusual about it.
Do you remember the name of the town that my father's farm was in when I was a kid?
Is it Sulphur Springs?
White Sulphur Springs was the name of it. I have no patience for sulfury water whatsoever.
Was there water in the well?
It was everywhere. I mean, if the sink dripped too much, it would stain, the sink basin would stain with the sulfur of the...
And did your dad make you drink that water when you were a kid?
Not always. We had a filter early on. Before filters were she, yeah. We had a filter.
Those in Sulphur Springs led the way in filter technology. Well, folks, I hope that you've enjoyed the hour with us on the Heritage Radio Network. Gerald Asher's book is great. I hope you do pick it up and look out for the one in the spring. We'll have him on again. And I hope you've enjoyed the hour with us as much as we have. I'm Francis Schaff.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys on RestaurantGuysRadio.com and the Heritage Radio Network.